own practice of Dana with my teachers, and like a sense of what would be appropriate will come up at the beginning of the retreat, and then there'll be some inner negotiation through the week. Oh, really? I mean, oh, that's way too much. Grumbling and all that. There's all this inner negotiation, and then finally, oh, yes, that's absolutely the right amount. And then a lot of happiness in giving and in supporting. I'm doing a training right now with Steve Armstrong called Touching the Earth, and it is a series of three retreats, but also online Dharma talks and readings and meditations and reflection. And I'm finding it very rich and very meaningful, even though it means going back to Langley, to that center that hasn't got a place to book. So Dana, it's an experience and a practice of connecting with our natural generosity. And this, I mean, last night I gave an evening of storytelling, and it was my decision to give whatever was offered as a donation to the World Wildlife Fund. So again, the generosity that I receive enables me to give and support worthy causes that are dear to me. So just pointing out, there is an elephant right here. A gift from a friend who had been traveling in Thailand. And this is a fig tree, and the Buddha attained his awakening under a Bodhi tree and Nigrodha Dhamma, yeah, Rukha. So, a little bit about the refuges. So we chanted the refuges, and I found it very energizing. I don't know if you did, but it's tremendously energizing to chant in this way. And I encourage you to consider making chanting part of your practice, because it really, there's a resonance and a quality of connecting with that sound and those words that takes us back through the centuries. And I have had the chance to practice in Burma, and some Buddhist nuns came and offered food to the retreatants at the monastery in the Skyne Hills where I was, and they chanted in the most dissonant, warbling, unusual way, and it was just, it felt otherworldly and beautiful and strange, and it awoke something in me about the lineage and the legacy that we are part of, and whether or not we see ourselves as, you know, Buddhists in some kind of absolute sense, we are still the recipients of these beautiful teachings. And that means that we are connected to the monks and nuns and lay people who have carried these teachings forward over the centuries. And I read about these remarkable stories. You know that these teachings were handed down orally for a number of centuries, and that required that the discourse be learned by heart, and really by heart, like really understanding and learning the words, engraving the words and the meaning in one's heart. So I might have told this story, you may have heard it before, but I think it was in the 1980s, a young boy in Sri Lanka who had been adopted by a Christian family. When he was about 3 years old, his foster father discovered Dhammaruan sitting cross-legged in his room, chanting. He was chanting the words of the Metta Sutta. Karaniyamata kusalena yan tan santang padang abhisamecha. And this lovely child's warbling voice, his foster father recognized that perhaps this, you know, was a Buddhist chant, and he took him to meet some Buddhist monks who said that Dhammaruan at the age of 3 was chanting in the style of Buddhaghosa, 5th century common era Buddhist scholar and monk. And so he became a kind of cause célèbre, famous boy, and he even identified the ruins of a Buddhist monastery that had been overgrown and abandoned. And but eventually, at the age of about 10, he pretended that he had forgotten all these past lives. Because what the monks said was that Dhammaruan was the reincarnation of what are known as banaka reciters. So an individual whose responsibility it was to learn by heart one of the discourses, and then eventually to teach it to someone else who would learn it by heart and pass it along. So I don't know if you ever saw the movie, I think it was Fahrenheit 451, or read the book, but people are learning books by heart and passing them on. I know, to think of learning David Copperfield by heart, what a feat that would be. So I mention that because this lineage really is very rich, and there is very, very much to be explored there for you if you're interested. And in June, Victoria Insight Meditation Society will be hosting Viradhammo, Ajahn Viradhammo, a Buddhist monk from Ontario. So that will be really an opportunity to practice with a monastic. And if you ever get up to Kamloops, I encourage you to visit Birken Forest Monastery with Ajahn Sona. So what does it mean to take refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha? To take refuge in the Buddha can really be understood in a number of different ways. And the first, of course, is to consider the historical Buddha, who was not a god, not a deva, not a spirit, but a human being who led a sheltered life and then embarked on a quest to understand the round of birth and death. What causes beings to get caught on the wheel of samsara? And also to explore how we can free ourselves. So the Buddha's journey, his struggle, his awakening, and his decision to teach, that is our legacy. And his is a model of tremendous compassion for the suffering of human beings and tremendous generosity. So taking refuge in the historical Buddha is one way to understand that, but also taking refuge in all the enlightened beings throughout history who have sought to alleviate suffering in the world. Of course, in our own lives, we may have encountered beings like this. I remember once traveling on the bus in Massachusetts, And it was kind of a cold, wet, rainy night. And I was listening to an audiobook of a memoir by Nelson Mandela. And just hearing his story was so moving. And specifically, his insight that his work and his path was not just to liberate the oppressed, but also to liberate the oppressors. And around me on the bus, there were college students on their laptops. This was before iPads. And next to me was a Vietnamese refugee. And we spoke for a little bit, and he told me that he was working at a fish processing plant near Boston and sending his earnings home to his family. And I asked about his living situation, and it sounded very bare and very simple, very minimal. And his whole entire focus was supporting his family at home. And I thought about, you know, the great work of Nelson Mandela and the private Buddha, you could say, that bodhisatta, the bodhisattva of this individual who was sacrificing really his own pleasure and ease in order to support others. So taking refuge in the Buddha is also taking refuge in our own potential for awakening. And I don't think of that as some kind of grand possibility, but really as the potential we honor each time we take our seat in meditation. Because we are emulating in our posture the resolve and the upright and steadfast determination of the Buddha when he took his seat under the Bodhi tree. And even though, you know, the Buddha was asking how to resolve the suffering of beings on the grand scale, when we take our seat in meditation, we are encountering our own suffering. Our uncertainty, our fear and concern for the world, our grief over the news, the death of children in war zones. So we take our seat and we are the Buddha at that moment. We are awakening our own potential. So this is what it means to take refuge. And to take refuge in the Dhamma, again, we can understand this in a few different ways. The word Dhamma actually comes from the Sanskrit root dhr, D-H-R, and it means to uphold, to support, or the law. So the Buddha appropriated this word from the Hindu tradition, where, you know, to enact one's dharma means to enact one's responsibilities and duties as a householder, as a son, as a parent. And he broadened the meaning of the word to mean the way things are, nature, reality, the truth of impermanence, that things arise, have a duration, and pass away. So we take refuge in the Dharma, and that's taking refuge in the Buddha's teachings. but also taking refuge in the truth of the way things are. This is a poem from a Russian poet, Marina Tsvetaeva. I don't know how to pronounce it. She had a very difficult life because she lived in the 20th century in Europe and was caught up in war, dislocation, politics. She says, "I know the truth. Give up all other truths. No need for people anywhere on earth to struggle. Look, it is evening. Look, it is nearly night. What do you speak of, poets, lovers, generals? The wind is level now. The earth is wet with dew. The storm of stars in the sky will turn to quiet. And soon, all of us will sleep under the earth. We who never let each other sleep above it." So she addresses her poem to poets, to lovers, and to generals. Generals, why would she address her poem to generals? She says, "Soon all of us will sleep under the earth, we who never let each other sleep above it." So, in my interpretation, she is simply speaking of the friction and the conflict and the war that arises between human beings. And really, she's speaking of the truth of suffering. So to take refuge in the Dhamma is not easy because it's taking refuge in the fact that we age, that we die, that we grow ill, that we have to, in a sense, let go. One of our participants this morning was speaking about that, letting go, even letting go of books. It's not easy. And then at a certain point, it's necessary, and it becomes easy. I think of my mother and her house. She's lived in that house for almost 60 years. And she's beginning to let go. But there's this practice of opening to the necessity of letting go. You know, and we can practice that when we practice generosity, when we give up our time, when we help others, even when we give away what is precious to us. It's a wonderful opportunity to practice letting go, which will be necessary. So this taking refuge in the Dhamma, it's a radical invitation really to take refuge in equanimity and in mindfulness. When there is pain, when there is suffering, to skillfully turn our attention and know it as much as we are able. To take refuge in the Sangha. So that's what we're doing here today. We're taking refuge in each other. Even though we may not know each other, we have created a Sangha by virtue of sitting together in silence. And really, the Sangha means the community and usually refers to the community of monastics, monks and nuns. But a Sangha is also any community of support where there is mutual respect, appreciation, encouragement. So, over the last few years, I've been thinking about the ways that we humans grow in spiritual depth and understanding, whether or not we belong to any particular faith tradition. In many cultures, the model is of someone who chooses to live apart from the hustle and bustle of the world, who goes on retreat to a monastery, to a cave, and contemplates in silence and solitude. And in that model, reflection is really the main part of daily life. And every aspect of life is available for study. When I went to be a cook at the retreat center in Massachusetts, one of my teachers, she said to me, this will really be of great benefit to your practice because of living in community. And it was true that it was. There were a lot of personalities rubbing up against each other in that setting. And it was tremendously beneficial and very, very, very challenging at times. And when I was the main cook, I would bristle when other people came through the kitchen just as I was preparing my meal, you know. And when the yogis would leave me a note praising my soda bread or thanking me, then, you know, my self-esteem, oh, I'm a good cook. And then there would be a disastrous failure in the kitchen of some kind or another. So, stepping out of the busyness, the moment-to-moment engagement with doing and becoming isn't easy, but that's what we've been up to today. And really, one of the reasons why we come and do a practice like this, and I think that weekend retreats, whether they're one day or 2 days, are actually more difficult than residential retreats, because we're so close. You know, we've just driven a few blocks or cycled or walked across town, and everything that's calling to us is very close at hand, saying, oh, but the laundry, oh, but the, and whatever it is, you know, our to-do list that's a mile long. So it really is a great act of renunciation and resolve to come and practice together like this. And what it's offering us is the opportunity to bring our practice into our daily lives with even greater continuity, with greater clarity, with greater mindfulness. So one of the things, you know, in taking refuge in the Sangha, you could say we are taking refuge in friendship. And I think friendship is such a remarkable gift. And you see children when they have a friend, you know. And they may be doing parallel play where each of them is building something with a set of blocks or drawing. But you have this sense that they're connecting and that they each feel the other's presence. And it is through friendship that we learn how to be patient, how to appreciate, how to be generous and help another. So it's wonderful to think about. The the friends we've had throughout our lives, the friends we have at this time in our lives. So I had a friend named Casey Emerson who lived across the street from me in Vancouver. And Casey and I eventually went to different schools and we lost touch. But I remember how we used to laugh together. We would go into fits of uncontrollable hysterical laughter. And that was really a great delight. It was a wonderful gift to receive. And it's amazing to me that I still remember that. I remember the pleasure of that laughter. So when I lived over on File Bay Road, there was a family living downstairs from me with two little boys. And one day I came home and they were playing under the oak trees. And they were simply taking turns, swinging each other by the arm and then falling on the ground laughing. Over and over again they did it. "It's my turn," one of them would say, and take hold of his brother's outstretched arm, swing him about, and send him laughing to the grass. So friendship can be that simple. And I think also we think of wisdom and how we learn from our friends, how our friends model qualities for us that we also want to embody. And it's so interesting to me to think about how, as a child and growing up, I intuitively learned about each of the precepts in different ways. And I remember I had a friend, Moira. And at a certain point, maybe when we were in grade 6 or 7, I noticed that when other girls were gossiping and speaking in a negative way about someone who wasn't present, Moira simply didn't participate. She didn't judge us or say anything. She just didn't join in. And it was so noticeable that it made an impression on me. And I decided that I didn't really like the feeling of gossiping. And I decided to just try that out, that way of being. So there's a word in the Pali language that describes a particular kind of friend, a Kalyanamitta. The literal meaning is beautiful or auspicious friend, and it's used to describe a spiritual friend. So in the Dhammapada, the Buddha says, if one finds a wise friend, a companion, firm of character, living a virtuous life, walk with that one, overcoming all troubles, mindful and happy. If one finds a wise friend, a companion, firm of character, living a virtuous life, walk with that one, overcoming all troubles, mindful and happy. In a famous discourse in the Samyutta Nikaya, Ananda, the Buddha's cousin, addressed the Buddha, and he remarked that friendship is half the holy life. Surely friendship is half the holy life. But the Buddha responds with a sharp rebuke, "Not so, Ananda, not so. This is the entire holy life. Ananda, that is good friendship, good companionship, good comradeship. When a bhikkhu, or a practitioner, has a good companion, a good comrade, it is to be expected that he will develop and cultivate the Noble Eightfold Path." So in this very short discourse, the Buddha draws a direct link between a bhikkhu or a practitioner's associations and his motivation to undertake the discipline of the spiritual journey in the form of the Eightfold Noble Path. The Buddha also goes on to identify himself as the ultimate spiritual friend, for it is through the Buddha's teachings that that individuals attain liberation. So, you know, Bhikkhu Bodhi, a wonderful Buddhist monk whose translations are remarkable in their elegance, simplicity, and beauty, and who freely gives commentaries on many of the discourses. Bhikkhu Bodhi writes, and he's speaking about how we are powerfully affected by our association with others. He says, "Far from coming to our personal relationships with a fixed and immutable character, our regular and repeated social contacts implicate us in a constant process of osmosis, psychological osmosis, that offers precious opportunities for growth and transformation. Like living cells engaged in a chemical dialogue with their colleagues, our minds transmit and receive a steady barrage of messages and suggestions that may work profound changes even at levels below the threshold of awareness. Particularly critical to our spiritual progress is our selection of friends and companions who can have the most decisive impact upon our personal destiny." Amazing. Amazing. And what's so interesting is that in preparing for the stories I told last night, I was reading about the Buddha's cousin, Ananda, and these beautiful descriptions of his dedication, his remarkable memory, the qualities of being that he embodied. But one particular comment that I think it's Nyaponika Tera makes is that it is no doubt that being in the presence of Ananda had left a deep imprint on all those who encountered him. I think we've experienced that with people in our lives, that there is a way in which their presence touches us, reminds us of our own potential. So, just a few more thoughts. So, a Kalyana Mitta. A Kalyana Mitta is one who gives good counsel. He restrains one from doing evil. He encourages one to do good. He informs one of what is unknown to oneself, and he points out the path to heaven. So I was telling Rhonda and Sandra at lunch that in about a week and a half or so, I'm going up to Kamloops to see a friend and her friend's son, who's going to be 20 years old. And we've been texting a bit. He communicates mostly through texting and through Facebook. So we've been texting, and I suggested that we make an Indian meal for his birthday. He was really excited about that and happy about that. And I've been thinking about how I'm concerned for him, because, you know, he's 19, almost 20, and he doesn't seem to have formed wise companions and formed good relationships with wise companions. And he has fallen into using drugs and alcohol. You know, it's not that unusual for young people to experiment, but I just really want him to know that know, he's not alone, that he has support, that he has people who are thinking of him and caring about him and want to encourage him to make good choices in his life. And, you know, it's such an interesting culture we live in, because we no longer have, you know, mentors or benefactors, or, you know, we no longer apprentice and learn from our relationship of being in the company of someone who has acquired a specific skill. But I think that that's no reason why we can't become mentors ourselves, and to see opportunities, you know, in skillful ways, not too heavy-handed, to guide and encourage young people. And certainly, you know, as an aunt, I'm so pleased to see my nephew. You know, he grew up in a fundamentalist Christian family, but he's totally into mindfulness. It's really interesting. He's even got his father, my brother, interested in mindfulness. And my older nephew, who used to try and convert me, my older nephew, he said, "Oh, Marco, I really want to hang out with you more and just soak up some of your wisdom." And he basically apologized for being such a brat. Well, he wasn't a brat, but he was a very sincere young Christian. With good intentions, you know, he was concerned for me. So, you know, to really reflect on taking refuge in the Sangha is taking refuge in the potential of friendship. The friendship we offer, the friendship we receive, and also in the friendship that we show towards ourselves, in the ways we care for ourselves, in the ways we forgive ourselves these, you know, mind storms of aversion, delusion, grasping. So one more poem, and I find that, you know, even in Victoria, you know, the world is coming to us in Victoria. You know, a few days ago I told stories at the art gallery, and I met a family, a mother and three children, who'd arrived from Syria 4 days earlier. The mother spoke English, but the children didn't, and yet I know that they responded to the music I was playing. And so I gave the children an opportunity to try my drum, and one of them made this gesture. He wanted to try the other side. It was so neat. So the world comes to us in Victoria, and we're not immune to the suffering of the world. Of course, we see the news, and we hear the news, we read the news. So it's, you know, it's up to us to both open to the truth of the suffering in the world, and also not to let ourselves be overwhelmed by despair, but really to see that through our practice, through the choices we make, we are also contributing to alleviating some of that suffering. And again, you know, Will and I were speaking about that spaciousness, that stepping back, and to recognize that these cycles of war, cycles of violence, they too lead to, eventually, we hope, lead to change. So this is again from the Polish poet Wisława Szymborska, translated by Joanna Trzeciak. After After every war, someone has to clean up. Things won't straighten themselves up after all. Someone has to push the rubble to the side of the road so the corpse-filled wagons can pass. Someone has to get mired in scum and ashes, sofa springs, splintered glass, and bloody rags. Someone has to drag in a girder to prop up a wall. Someone has to glaze a window, rehang a door. Photogenic? It's not, and takes years. All the cameras have left for another war. We'll need the bridges back and new railway stations. Sleeves will go ragged from rolling them up. Someone, broom in hand, still recalls the way it was. Someone else listens and nods. But already there are those nearby, starting to mill about, who will find it dull. From out of the ashes, someone still unearths rusted out arguments and carries them to the garbage pile. Those who knew what was going on here must make way for those who knew little, and less than little, and finally, as little as nothing. In the grass that has overgrown causes and effects, someone must be stretched out, blade of grass in his mouth, gazing at the clouds. So let's just sit for a few moments. So by setting a clear intention today to aim for continuity of mindfulness, we have been slowly but surely lifting the curtain of delusion, and shining the light on all aspects of our life, including the very filters through which we view our experience. So from the physical sensations in the body to feelings of unpleasant or pleasant to mental states to moods and emotions, nothing is outside the sphere of our practice. Nothing is beyond the potential of mindful awareness. So, just as we sit now, reflecting on the three refuges known as the Triple Gem, as we think of taking refuge in the Buddha, what makes sense to you? Is it the actual historical figure of the Buddha? Is it the many bodhisattvas in history? Or is it your own potential to awaken wisdom and understanding? Or all of these? And when we speak of taking refuge in the Dhamma, We can understand this to be the vast teachings of the Buddha, which can be simplified to three short phrases: avoid doing harm, perform acts that are wholesome, purify the mind. Or perhaps taking refuge in the Dhamma is simply taking refuge in the way things are. Shining the light of awareness on our own experience, allowing wisdom to grow as we recognize the truth of impermanence. And taking refuge in the Sangha, can understand this as taking refuge in those fellow seekers, known and unknown to us, or all those practitioners through the centuries who have supported these teachings and allowed them to flourish. Or we could very simply understand taking refuge in the Sangha as taking refuge in this beautiful quality of friendship. So again, may our practice truly be of benefit to all beings, and may all beings find true refuge.